Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The latest climate projections are increasingly dire, as the world climate clock now has only 7 years to reverse course. Increasingly, large and intense wildfires are one of the major changes we are seeing as climate change accelerates. Megadroughts are also increasing, which will trigger more big fires this spring and summer. Meanwhile, many elected officials are emphasizing the need to thin national forests in order to prevent more catastrophic destruction from these fires. Today we talk again with Dominic De La Salle, a chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Ashland, Oregon, about how no amount of thinning will actually prevent these fires, and in fact will just add more carbon emissions to the atmosphere than the fires themselves. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Always good to be on your informative show, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always good to have you on, too, especially in these really trying times. One of the things that it seems to be a general consensus about is that as climate chaos intensifies, so will wildfires, and we can expect a more intense and frequent wildfire season from now on. And I'm wondering if you see that as a consensus, or if within that consensus you see some disagreement.
I think by and large, the statement is correct. I think what we are seeing now is the face of climate change rearing its ugly head in much of the West. And it's doing so through fire activity. We're getting longer fire seasons. We're getting large fires, bigger fires, not necessarily more intense, but certainly bigger fires, more acres burning. And it's, you know, surprising to many people on your show here is the fact that with the increase of fire acres burning, we still are in a historical deficit. In the early 1900s, there were a lot more acres burning in a comparable dry situation. So it really, these big fires are following the drought and temperature increases that we're seeing through the West. But we're still not at the point of what it was like in the early 1900s when you had these bigger fires, and even before that, with a lot of indigenous burning that was taking place in forest and grassland ecosystems.
Well, I've had interesting conversations with people, especially after the really big fires in the west side of Oregon 2 years ago, about how these are the biggest fires of all time. I said, well, actually, there was a really huge fire in 1910 that burned across western Montana, throughout the total panhandle of Idaho and eastern Washington, and that was probably bigger than any of the fires that happened in 2020 in Oregon. And that's news to a lot of people, but they should read Timothy Egan's book, The Big Burn, and then you learn just how big a fire can be. And I wonder how you would compare that fire, which actually maybe set the stage for some of the issues you're bringing up now. But how do you compare that fire with the large fires that we're experiencing now?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the big burn in the 1910 period was met with picks and shovels. The Forest Service was forming itself at that time. It wasn't the agency that we have today. And it actually was responsible for a lot of the way the Forest Service came into evolution because of the concern of the loss of life, the loss of towns that was taking place. It was a comparable dry spell that was enveloping much of the Northern Rockies, spilling over into Washington State and Idaho and other places. So it was a massive burn. And we're seeing more of those types of big burns. And this has been going on now since about the 1980s. So there have been three cycles that have happened in the way fires have been burning over the last century and a half. During the early 1900s, there was a warm-up that was occurring that gave us more droughts and more fire activity, like the big burn. And then the middle part of the century, we saw a cooling period, and that was accompanied by a massive buildup of fire suppression forces by the U.S. Forest Service. They got into industrial fire suppression activities, suppressed most of the fires. At the same time, thousands of homes were being built in unsafe places under this false lull that we could put out all wildfires. So fast forward to the 1980s, when we really start to see the effects of climate change ramping up, we have a return to hot conditions, more droughts, and these extreme fire weather conditions that are now driving the vast majority of fires that we see and are the principal agents behind fires escaping containment. You can't put them out under these conditions. And what we're missing here is we continue to build homes in unsafe places during this climate overheating that's giving us more wildfires. And we're putting more emissions into the atmosphere that's causing the problem that we hope to solve.
I want to just talk a bit more about the 1910 fire, because I understand that that really set the tone for the creation of the National Forest Service as we know it, and as primarily as a firefighting unit. And did that also change our idea about fire, or were we already fire bad before that fire happened?
I think it certainly ushered in this notion that all fires are bad and all fires need to be put out. And so right around the late 1930s, the Forest Service advanced that to the concept of the 10 a.m. policy, that every fire start needed to be put out by 10 a.m. the next day. And that's contributed to the problem. I mean, you can't shut the fire spigot off. I mean, our forest, our grasslands, our shrub communities need periodic fire. They're getting too much in places like the Chaparral system in Southern California has too many human-caused fires, but we still have an overall fire deficit in our forest ecosystems. The dry forests need to rejuvenate themselves. These fires are ecologically beneficial to those forests, and under some conditions, when we don't have extreme fire weather, when we don't have fires bearing down on communities, we need to work with those fires for ecosystem benefits and not try to put every single one of them out, because eventually it's just going to come back to bite us in the butt.
Well, back in 2002, there was the infamous Biscuit Fire down your way in Southern Oregon. And that was a case, that fire started in mid-July. And my understanding is they didn't start to put it out right away. And then it, in the terms of the Forest Service, burned out of control. I'm wondering what your take was on the management of that fire. And then after that, we can get to the post-fire logging that happened.
Well, every fire involves a decision that's made by the incident command team at the point of ignition. And it really depends on a number of factors. It's art and science that goes into determining whether to put the fire out if you can, and whether to work with it for ecosystem benefits. At the time, the area was under drought conditions. I don't think they could have put it out anyhow. I mean, this is just the reality of the situation. The Chelmeopsis also is some of the steepest, most remote places left in Oregon, and a very unsafe condition to put firefighters into harm's way like that. We've got to think about the risk to firefighters, too, that are helping to protect our communities, that we don't want to put them in the backcountry in the middle of extreme fire weather, that are conditions where you can't put the fire out anyhow. So what we need to do is be protecting our communities by hardening homes, by doing defensible space, and getting to coexistence with wildfires. Because the way we are treating this, we are treating the effect of climate change, more wildfires, rather than the cause of these wildfires, which is emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels and logging our forests.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about forests being a really major source of carbon sequestration. And in fact, when I've been reading about all these geoengineering ideas about taking carbon out of the atmosphere, people like you point down to the fact that we have these forests, and that is the first, that's the biggest advantage we have. So how do we shift the viewpoint for the people in power who are making the decisions about how forests are managed and how they're either allowed to burn or not burn, or cut or not cut, to recognize the importance of our forests as major carbon sinks?
Yeah, so this has been, you know, the challenge that humanity faces right now. We are in a period of unprecedented climate velocity, and the planet itself is at risk. We've got to get off of fossil fuels. I mean, this is why we're having conflicts around the world right now. The situation between, with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, there's a big oil component to that. And we've got to get off of fossil fuels to really have a more politically stable climate, not just an atmospherically stable climate. And so in addition to that, we've got to look at our natural ecosystems as our lifeline to a safe climate. And it turns out that forests do this better than any terrestrial ecosystem. They're massive sponges of carbon, drawing down carbon from the atmosphere, storing it long-term in our old-growth forest and large trees. Those need to be part of any climate solution, natural climate solutions. Then it's not being addressed by any branch of the U.S. government, certainly not by the private sector, even though there are thousands of scientists around the world saying that we are missing the only opportunity that we have left, and that hourglass is down to the fine grains of what time we have left before climate change really becomes severe and catastrophic. I mean, you think it's bad now, 10, 20, 30 years from now, I just worry about the next generation and what we are doing to the planet and their choices going forward.
Let's talk a bit about how the forests sequester carbon. I was actually talking with a writer last week, Liz Carlisle, who's written a book called Healing Grounds, and talking about how our agricultural systems could also be redesigned so that they are much more carbon sinks and much less carbon emitters, which industrial agriculture is to a great extent. But she was talking about the whole network of carbon sequestration in the root systems of plants. Let's talk about how the root systems in forests are such a significant carbon sequestrator.
You know, it's only been the last decade or so that we've discovered this new and exciting benefit that we get from our older forests. And, you know, for decades, we've been doing these bio-blitzes around the planet, just determining what the biodiversity and water quality values are of our older forest and large trees. And that took about three decades of intense bio-blitzing surveys all over the planet. And it's only the last 10 years now that we have discovered that these forests are absolutely critical to our climate future. When you go through an old-growth forest, you know you're in a cathedral. And it's, you know, just splendid. The temperature inside those forests is a lot cooler than if you're in a clear cut. And you can think of them, in addition to their biodiversity and watershed values, as big sticks of carbon. So through the miracle of photosynthesis, forests capture carbon from the atmosphere, combine it with their absorption of sunlight, their uptake of water, and they manufacture plant foods. And they store those plant foods as carbon. So when you see that big tree out in the forest, it's a big stick of carbon that's been accumulating from the atmosphere for many centuries in the older trees and older forest. And as the trees increase in size, they put on more of that carbon. Right around when they get to about 80 years or so, they're really starting to massively increase their carbon uptake. They've got a lot more surface area of needles and leaves to absorb carbon. So they're big sticks of carbon. They're filtering our atmosphere. They're producing oxygen so we could breathe. And they store it in the forest, in the soils, in the roots, in the root wads, and the foliage. And so we've got to keep that carbon in those forests and not log them, because when we log them, most of the carbon goes up into the atmosphere and contributes to climate change.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Salle, a chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Ashland, Oregon, about how no amount of thinning in the national forest will prevent megafires, and in fact will just add more carbon emissions to the atmosphere than the fires themselves. I was reading one of your articles recently, and one of the things that struck me as really important is semantics and how we describe what the forests are made of and how that shapes the way that we would manage them. So let's talk a little bit about the problems you have with the semantics of the Forest Service as they are right now.
Yeah, so it really comes down to how we see the forest. And I'll give you a good example of this. A few years ago, when I was starting to put together a co-edited project that I did with Dr. Chad Hansen, subtitled Nature's Phoenix, I had just finished my book on temperate and boreal rainforests of the world, and I thought I knew what a forest was. Yeah, I had calibrated my imagery around these cathedral old growth forests, and that's what I thought. And it wasn't until I took a hike with my daughter at the time, I think she was 8 years old, we were sitting in this big patch of burned trees where all the trees were dead, at the top of Grizzly Peak in Ashland. And it was a lovely spring day. The snow had just melted. The place was alive with wildlife. There were woodpeckers, hummingbirds, dragonflies, butterflies, flowering plants all over the place. And, you know, I had been fighting for years with the perception that the forest was dead. You know, decision makers like the Forest Service, members of Congress think it's a catastrophe, but it's not. It's a rebirth of the forest. Life and death are part of the processes that play out in these forests that are so essential for their ecology. And so I had to change my perception of what a forest is. It's unfortunate that the Forest Service doesn't look at it that way. A lot of fire scientists don't look at it that way. They see fuels ready to burn. I see an ecosystem ready to rejuvenate. So how we see the forest determines what we do to the forest. And I try to see it through the lens of nature, through the lens of what the ecology of that forest is, instead of looking at it in terms of, you know, removing fuels that have a commercial value that wind up contributing to the problem that people think they're solving by putting more emissions into the atmosphere, and setting back that natural rejuvenation process by logging the forests.
Let's talk about that concept of fuels, because the way you just mentioned it, it seems like fuels is two-sided. One side of it is fuels that will burn up in the next forest fire, and the other one seems to be the commodity of timber.
Yeah, I try to avoid the whole terminology around fuels. It's part of the industrial fire mentality, firefighting mentality. That these are ecosystems. It might be flammable vegetation, no doubt, but to call it fuels has a commodity component to it. And I want to look at those as living, breathing ecosystems that are capable of rejuvenating themselves, and that nature can handle itself. It may need a boost at times, but certainly not the way we have been treating her by removing massive amounts of trees, whether it's before or after the fire. That is not the way we should be handling the fire situation. We should be helping communities prepare for these fire events by hardening homes, by doing defensible space management, and solving for the root causes of these big fires, which is emissions into the atmosphere. We've got to stop treating our atmosphere as a dumping ground for carbon dioxide emissions.
Well, one of the big debates seems to be over, quote, thinning in the forests, which sounds very benign. It sounds like something I would do with my rose bushes every spring. I was looking at some photographs in one of your articles of an area that's been thinned, and it reminds me of some forests I went through outside of Baker City last summer, which were amazing. There was like one tree, like three trees per acre or something. This is considered thinning. So let's talk about the ideology behind the necessity of thinning to prevent massive forest fires, and then your take on what would be a much better solution.
Yeah, so, you know, it's not going to stop these big fires. You know, I mean, we've got to come to realization that we have limits in terms of what we can do to direct nature. And I think that organizations, agencies that are supporting these massive thinning projects are being disingenuous, because we cannot stop these large fires in extreme fire weather. I mean, the town that I live in Talent, Oregon, is a good example of this. The Alameda fire during the Labor Day fires of 2020 ripped through my town. It burned structure to structure. It had nothing to do with the lack of thinning in the backcountry. It was all about the lack of home hardening that was taking place during an extreme fire weather situation. Triple digit temperatures, low humidity, drought, high winds. All of that is the face of climate change. And we continue to treat the effect and not the cause. And even if we were able to slow down some of these fires, we wind up putting more emissions into the atmosphere by logging the forest than the fire itself would put into the atmosphere. So we're contributing to the problem, not the solution. It's only going to get worse as climate becomes the top-down driver, increasingly, of these big fires that we're seeing today. It's not a solution to thin these forests. It's the problem.
How does thinning the forest put more carbon into the atmosphere?
So again, you know, these forests are big sticks of carbon. That carbon has been pulled out of the atmosphere, and if we're talking about a mature forest, for decades to centuries. And so when you cut down that forest, you immediately release, within a year or so, about a third of the carbon that was stored in those forests. Some of it comes out of the soils by disturbing the soil layer, and most of it comes from the decomposition of slash that's left on the ground, stumps and logs that are left there that will decompose and emit carbon to the atmosphere. Then you take that log, you put it on the back of a logging truck, and if it's on private lands, it could be shipped overseas. So you've got that emissions. You send it to the mill, and they're going to have certain levels of efficiency in processing it into wood products using fossil fuels, more emissions going to the atmosphere. You make it into something. Maybe it's a piece of furniture. Maybe it's a piece of paper. More fossil fuels going to the atmosphere. And then that product itself is not going to last as long as the big tree that was cut down in that forest. So eventually, all the carbon that was in that forest is going to go to the atmosphere instead of being in the forest. Now, clearly, some forests are going to burn over time, but by and large, the big trees in those forests are much, much better at storing carbon than cutting down the forest, releasing at least temporarily, the first year or so, releasing a third or so of the carbon, and then eventually all the carbon. The trees are much better at storing carbon than wood products are.
Well, when they talk about thinning, you get the impression that they're taking out little trees, they're taking out younger trees. But what, in fact, are they doing when they so-called thin the forests?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, they are taking out smaller trees. I want to acknowledge that. And there are some benefits to thinning, particularly if it's done in the right places, the right for the right reasons. Under the Northwest Forest Plan, for instance, the wet forest in the late successional reserves, a lot of them are clear cuts. They're recovering clear cuts. And the thinking there is that by thinning out some of the small trees, you can speed up the process to older forests. So that makes sense to me. But to think that this is going to stop the fire problem is completely disingenuous. And most often what happens is the big trees are taken to pay for the small trees. And it's the big trees that are the most fire-resistant elements in the forest. And you leave behind the flammable logging slash. You increase the speed at which wind can penetrate the forest, which means the fires can burn faster through those thinned areas. You have drying out of the understory. You have an understory response. So you got to go back every 10 years. How are you going to pay for it if you've already taken the big trees out? And then you've got to hope that the lightning bolt or a unnatural fire ignition from arson or accidental event hits that site on the ground. And the odds of that is like a needle in a haystack, that your site that you are thinning is going to encounter a fire when the flammable vegetation is at its lowest point. You only have about a narrow window of 10 years. So when you put all of that together, and plus the fact that you're putting emissions into the atmosphere by doing this, it's not a solution.
We also talk about the, the negative take on high severity burns. They're bad, and we want to avoid high severity burns. But in fact, you seem to have a different take on the necessity of high severity burns.
I know, and you know, I thought at first when Dr. Hansen and I published Nature's Phoenix subtitled, we got a lot of flack from the scientific community, even though there were 27 other scientists on that book with us. We got flack. However, that book was based on examples from forests all over the world where we have seen incredible levels of biodiversity, comparable to what you get in an old growth forest, by the way, in these severe burn patches. And you got to, you know, think about it. All of a sudden, you've got this big pulse of dead trees, which is wonderful habitat for woodpeckers, for bats, for denning small mammals, for owls, for hawks. And then you've got the understory response with the wildflowers. And, you know, a lot of morel pickers know the best places to go find morels are in these recent burn patches. And so this is the thing about nature. I mean, the more we get intimate with nature, the more we discover these remarkable rejuvenation capacities if we just allow the forest to do what they're going to do. Now, in some places, it's going to need a boost. Like in the plantations, the clear cuts that we have already damaged, there's need for restoration. But in these places that have burned severely, particularly if it was a mature old growth forest before the burn, it's as important after the burn as it was before.
Well, I got a sense that the Forest Service thinks of areas that haven't burned as potential fuel, basically, for a big fire, which is one reason they go in and thin it. How much validity is there to that viewpoint?
You know, the best place to test that hypothesis is to look at these areas that have had large beetle kill forest patches. And places that come to mind would be California, the Rockies, where we've seen some very large insect infestations caused by, again, climate change. What's happening is the forests are dying back, and a lot of beetles can detect that die back. And the beetle populations themselves are not suffering winter loss because our winters are getting warmer. So it's this vicious cycle, right? With the climate being the top-down driver. But we've seen very large patches of beetle-killed forest sometimes go through a fire event. And when the fire goes through those forests, it burns on the ground because there's no live foliage in the overstory to crown the fire out. So the beetles have actually done our work for us, that these forest fires are not going to burn hot. They're not going to burn fast through beetle-killed patches like this. The dead trees are not the problem. The small trees can be the problem, and we see this mostly in industrial logged landscapes. My colleagues and I did the largest study ever on this, published in a peer-reviewed journal. We looked at 1,500 forest fires over 11 different states in the West, 23 million acres affected by these fires over that period. And what we found is the areas that had the most intense logging were burning in the most uncharacteristically severe fires. Not wilderness areas, not national parks, not roadless areas, but heavily logged landscapes. A year later, that study was, researchers from Oregon State University found very similar findings for fires in the Roseburg area of Southern Oregon. They burned hottest under extreme fire weather in industrial logged landscapes. So if we're looking at solutions, we got to solve for climate change, and we've got to reduce our logging footprint.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Ashland, Oregon, about how no amount of thinning in the national forest will prevent megafires, and in fact, will just add more carbon emissions to the atmosphere than the fires themselves. I wanted to go back 20 years to the Biscuit Fire, which burned in 2002. We mentioned it earlier in the show. And I wanted to talk about how that fire burned in comparison to a fire that had happened in the same area approximately, I think, about 10 years earlier.
Yeah, so I was on the ground when that was happening, and it was a flashpoint politically at the time because even President George W. Bush came out to announce his healthy forest initiative, which is, you know, Orwellian because it's actually the opposite. But anyway, we were there during that whole event, and it was a landscape-changing wildfire burning mostly through roadless areas and the Kalmiopsis Wilderness Complex From an ecosystem perspective, it was a pretty typical mixed severity fire. And the amount of high severity was about 20% or so of the entire fire complex. When you think about that, about 80% of the remaining portion of the fire actually burned in low to moderate intensities. And there were some areas that didn't burn at all. And so it was kind of this mosaic of different fire severities that we see in these large fires that are really very beneficial ecologically. And, you know, when we see variety like that, variety in nature is the spice of life. There's habitat in there that didn't burn that could be great nesting habitat for all kinds of hawks and owls. And then there's some patches that burned severely and the shrub layers come back, and that's foraging habitat, even for deer, and great places to find morel mushrooms. This is the way nature designed those forests to burn. Now, where we saw it burning uncharacteristically was in the plantations, and everything cooked in the plantations, which are hurting to begin with anyhow, because they have very little biodiversity in them. They have very little structure in them. And, you know, they've been degraded to start off with by logging. And typically what happens is after those fires, they're logged again. And so it's just adding insult to injury.
Let's jump ahead 18 years and talk about the fires that burned through Western Oregon in 2020. You made a reference a little earlier to the Great Labor Day fires. And I wondered how you saw the patterns of burns there. I remember talking to your colleague, Timothy Inglesby, during the fires, actually, and he was theorizing that he expected that the area along the Mackenzie River that was going to be the most devastated would be the plantations, and he expected that the wildlands, the wilderness areas, to be a lot less impacted. I'm wondering if that turned out to be true.
Yeah, I think by and large, that's the overall pattern. And there, you know, there. Recent study that was published that came out only a few months ago showed that our older forests throughout the Pacific Northwest are so much better capable of being resistant and resilient to wildfires than heavily logged areas. And those older forests can actually function as fire refugia. They are generally burned in lower intensities, and they get through these fire events. And even if they do burn in high severity, then they become important habitat, you know, in the kind of nature's phoenix theme for all kinds of species that need those young regenerating forests. So it's not an end, it's a beginning. And this is what we see in nature, that the areas that are best capable of being adapted to wildfires are the oldest forest and the largest trees. And the maladaptive places are the heavily logged landscapes that have been degraded before the fire, and they're degraded after the fire.
Now, do you have any examples, specific examples of how you saw that playing out in the fires from 2 years ago?
Yeah, so I think this is the same thing that I saw in the Biscuit Fire back in 2002. I went back a year later. I went back 10 years later. And I've been doing this in all these burn areas, seeing the same thing over and over again. If an old growth forest burns severely in the fire, if you go back a year or two later, it's rejuvenating in a vibrant way. If you go back 10 years later, the place is just chock full of all kinds of wildlife and conifer regeneration going on in most of these severely burned patches. Now, I've had study plots that have gone using a transect from a severely burned patch of old growth into a clear cut, also severely burned by the same fire. And what I've seen is, along that same transect, going from the vibrant, rejuvenating, old-growth, severely burned forest into the clear cut, very little rejuvenation happening in the clear cut. The soils get cooked, the trees don't come back very well, and what typically happens is there's post-fire salvage logging, so that damages the soils, and the trees take longer to come back, and then they go back and they plant in dense rows of small trees 10 years later, they got a fire problem because all the trees are compacted in there like kindling. That's actually what we saw in the Biscuit Fire. The Biscuit Burn area has burned repeatedly over the last 30 or 40 years. Go back to 1987, places that were salvage log that then burned in the Biscuit Fire of 2002 burned in the highest intensities. It's because of the logging slash left on the ground, the tree planting in tight rows, that just exacerbated the fire effects.
And there's been a significant fire in the Biscuit area since then, I recall. Because there was some pretty intensive post-fire logging after the Biscuit Fire, very contentious at the time, I'm wondering how those areas fared in the fires of 2020.
Yeah, so the Biscuit area, to my knowledge, did not burn again in 2020, but it has burned repeatedly since the 2002 burn. And there's been a lot of on-the-ground work that's gone on in there, including with my colleague Luke Rudiger, who goes into these fire patches and actually looks at how they're rejuvenating. And based on his work, you know, go into the wilderness complex, the roadless areas, they're doing fine after these repeat burns. And in fact, the fire burns in the lower intensities because it's already had the flammable vegetation mostly reduced from the prior event. And I think as long as the interval between these big fire events is within the natural range of variability, the forest will do fine. But what is a concern is when that interval starts to get compressed, that you get shorter periods between these big fire events because of climate change, because of logging, that could result in big changes to our forest. Right now, it seems like they're doing okay. If they're not logged, they come back. But we are rolling the dice on our forest and our future by magnifying climate change events, tossing more carbon into the atmosphere, either burning fossil fuels or logging the forest. That's the biggest concern.
Well, I'm wondering how your area that was burned by the Alameda Fire, how that's doing, because that was mostly built, that was mostly like human landscape, right? I mean, were there any actual natural forests that were burned in the Alameda Fire?
You know, I had a surreal event experience with the Alameda Fire. I was in front of my computer writing to our representatives, the state and congressional representatives. I was really worried. You know, I do a lot of monitoring of climate signals because I work on climate change. And during that time, we had triple-digit temperatures for 2 weeks. We were in a historic drought. We had unusual high winds coming out of the east, cross-continental. And I was sounding the alarm bells. My power went off 2 hours later. I go outside, and there's a wall of smoke descending on my community. And it was an alleged arson event that started in a park in Ashland, and fortunately didn't affect the Ashland community because the winds were blowing in the other direction, and took out in one day, in a single day, that fire took out 2,700 structures moving from Talent into nearby Phoenix. Had nothing to do with thinning in the backcountry. You know, it did race through the Bear Creek corridor, which is our Central Park. And, you know, you got to have trees somewhere, right? And that's in a river corridor. But the bigger problem was the structures. This was a structure-to-structure fire because the community was not prepared. There was no hardening of homes. And the eerie part of it is later that night, there were propane tanks exploding like 4th of July fireworks as the mobile homes were being destroyed. Now, we're 2 years into this, and there's still communities that have not relocated. There is no home hardening going on. It's great to see my community rebuilding from the ashes, but it's like we didn't learn anything from that event because there's nothing that has changed.
Do you see that in the federal legislation that's being proposed, I mean, if we ever get the Build Back Better, now I guess it's what Build Back Better Without Fossil Fuels movement, that we could get some guidance and support federally and also on the state level to build in a different way, to build back in a way that is actually in alignment with climate realities?
You know, I think that is really essential. And there's some good and some bad in the Build Back Better. And even if it eventually becomes a factor again in Congress, I was one of hundreds of scientists that wrote to members of Congress saying, you need to strip out the logging provisions from Build Back Better. There's all kinds of subsidies, federal subsidies using taxpayer dollars to subsidize logging that only makes the problem worse. All of that money needs to go into clean, renewable energy and helping communities with adapting to climate change, which means, in part, home hardening, defensible space, helping communities of color, helping disadvantaged communities deal with the health ramifications of what we're addressing with more smoke in our air sheds. That's where the federal government can help. It's unfortunate that even Build Back Better, and especially the infrastructure law that did get passed, has massive amounts of federal logging subsidies in it that is only going to contribute to the problem that future generations are going to be dealing with increasingly.
How about our congressional delegation? Where are they at about this?
You know, they're in large extent, they are contributing to the problem. I mean, there are some good things that they got in there, but as long as there are federal subsidies for logging in any legislation, it's not a solution. And I wish our delegation were stronger on that. In fact, I wish our state delegation were stronger on that, too. It's not just a federal problem. We see it in the state budget allocations, too. And this is what I was writing about the day of the fire before it was happening. I was frustrated with my state representatives. I was frustrated with the governor, with my congressional representatives, that they weren't listening to what communities need, instead bending to commercial logging interests that are getting these federal subsidies.
I'm thinking about back to 2 years and 3 years ago, and at that time, there seemed to be like two key battles going on in Oregon, and one was around stopping the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal, which would have produced massive amounts of greenhouse gas, and it took the state up until 2019 to start taking a firm stand against that project, and at the same time, there's all this logging being proposed. I wonder if you see the interconnection between those two fights.
I do, indeed. And I see the inconsistencies there. I mean, we've got some of members of our delegation that have been quite strong on seeking ways to shift our economy out of fossil fuel and into the clean, renewable energy sector. I mean, we should have been doing this 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, they have been good on that. But at the same time, the inconsistency is not recognizing the contribution that forestry emissions are making to the global climate emergency. And until that is recognized, they're going to be out of step with the mainstream scientific community, thousands of us that are saying we've got to look at natural climate solutions as part of our efforts to get off of fossil fuels. Whether that carbon is going into the atmosphere because it's being converted from extracting dino carbon from oil reserves, or it's going into the atmosphere because we are logging our forest. Carbon is carbon, and we've got to stop treating the atmosphere as a dumping ground for our carbon emissions.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Ashland, Oregon, about how no amount of thinning in the national forest will prevent megafires and, in fact, will just add more carbon emissions to the atmosphere than the fires themselves. Well, before we started recording today, Dominic, you were talking about being in Washington, D.C. last week at some hearings, and you had an interesting partner you were traveling with. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what that was about and what you think you might have achieved.
Yes, so there was a congressional hearing last week in the House Oversight Committee chaired by Congressman Ro Khanna, who actually does get this. So I have some faith and confidence that there are some members of Congress that actually get what we're trying to show folks that there's a better way. And I was on a panel with my friend Carole King, songwriter Carole King, who's an amazingly powerful, strong woman with incredible activist roots. We all know her amazing songwriting and singing, but she's a big advocate of what we're talking about. And thankfully, she was there because she got all the notoriety from the press and got the message out a heck of a lot better than I can as a pointed-headed scientist. She carried the clout of a well-known figure that is concerned about this, that, you know, the thousands of scientists couldn't deliver that message as effectively as she can. And there, it was a good hearing. I really challenged the Forest Service Chief, Randy Moore, some of the things that he was saying, including the Forest Service is now poised to use the infrastructure funding primarily to ramp up, quadruple the amount of logging in our forest at levels that we haven't seen since the Reagan administration. And so we challenged them on that. And that's going to remain a concern because the Forest Service views that as fuel reduction and is not looking at the contributions of emissions to the atmosphere, making the problem worse. And there was a rather interesting exchange that took place between myself and one of the Republican members on the committee who was implying that I was a communist because I support clean, renewable energy, and that he was very concerned about too much what he called thatch in the forest and that we needed to remove that thatch. And I had to show him some pictures of some very big trees, not the thatch that was being removed. And we had an interesting exchange where I had visited with a member the day before, and he was showing pictures of his grandkids. And when he was pushing back at me, I tried to reach into his heart. And I said to him, "Congressman, I also am a grandfather. I have two amazing daughters and three wonderful grandkids. Like you, I am concerned about what this world is going to be like when our kids are adults." And I could see his entire face light up. And I could have argued with him on the science grounds, but what it really came down to is we have a common thread. We care about our families. And if you could see it through that lens, that what we're trying to do here is to create a better world for our families, then hopefully we could move the agenda from an argument over jobs and over science and over this and over that to we both have concerns about our families and what we are leaving for that next generation. Maybe that's the way to bring everybody together.
Now, do you feel like you did make a dent in his opinion that you're a communist because you support renewable energy?
I hope so. I think we both left each other with an impression of, you know, the situation at hand here, and that inflammatory remarks, which I could have counted differently, are really, you know, part of the theatrics that you get in congressional hearings. I mean, look at what Judge Jackson is going through with her Supreme Court nomination. Wonderful woman, strong woman. So glad that there are senators there that are supporting her, but there's been some crazy stuff thrown at her, yet she has stood within her integrity and her power. And I think that's what we need to do. That's also the subject of my new book, Speaking Truth to Power, subtitled. It's about people like that, standing up to this crazy stuff with integrity and their own power and reaching into the hearts and minds of people so that we can get through this together.
I was listening to some of the hearings over the last couple of days of Judge Jackson and just marveling at her composure. She had this very long pause after, I don't remember, it might have been Tom Cotton asking this really stupid question about a school book that was in the curriculum for a private school that she happens to be on the board of directors for. And she had such a great answer, but that pause, and since I'm listening on the radio, I don't know if she's sighing or she's rolling her eyes or whatever she's doing. I got the impression she showed a little bit of exasperation, but mostly this great composure. And I thought she's a lesson for all of us to stand up to this. I'm curious about what Carole King had to say at the hearing that you were with her at and how she was listened to.
Yeah, she's an amazing, powerful woman, and I'm so honored to have been her witness companion. at the hearing. I learned so much just from being in her light for the 3 days that we worked together as a team. And she has this capacity to reach into hearts and minds that I think very few people have that kind of enlightened perspective on the planet. And we need more women and more powerful people like that taking stands, like Judge Jackson, like Carole King. And Yoshi was well-schooled on the science of what's going on climate change, on forest logging, and she was able to deliver it in a way that I don't think any of us can. She got a lot of attention from the press. It was just fun walking the streets with her. Everywhere we went, everyone knew her. I got a chance to know her personally. I'm a budding musician myself, so we were able to talk music and not just science. And she's just such a humble human being that, in her own words, she just kind of fell into this success story about her life. But I think it's a lot more than that, just by hanging around with her and just listening to how she presented herself at the congressional hearing that just elevated the issue that I've been working on for 30 years now in no way that has ever happened in my career. So it was great that she was able to get the attention that is so well deserved for our planet, our forest, and our families.
I just wonder what it's like for some of these congresspeople, like the guy who called you a communist, to be listening to this woman who wrote "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?" A natural woman, and hearing her talking about forests. Do you think that there was maybe some kind of funny disconnect where something shifted for them?
Absolutely. And I saw it. I mean, that was the entry point for her. And we got member meetings for the first time since I've been doing this in 30 years. Every one of my meetings was with a member of Congress. Normally you get the staff, which are very smart people, no doubt. But when you get a member, it's a different kind of meeting. And she has that kind of notoriety to open those doors. And that's what you know, and this is what we need. We need more celebrities, I guess, working with scientists, more women of power working as scientists and as people in the arts and theater community, the celebrities that are engaged in finding solutions to climate change, like Leonardo DiCaprio. And there's many of them out there that just have that kind of notoriety that can get through to people. And I personally witnessed it by being alongside my friend.
And what do you think it has done for you and your future lobbying and organizing and writing?
Boy, I would love to work with more celebrities. I mean, they accomplished in one day what I've been trying to do in 30 years. So it is such an honor to be working with people that care about the planet, even if they're not celebrities. We can't do this alone. We've got to do it as a rising grassroots movement of scientists, activists, musicians, all walks of lives. This is the only way we're going to solve this so we can create a better world for the next generation.
Well, I also have a feeling that people like Carole King and Leonardo DiCaprio might read the writings of you and other scientists, and that gives them the grounding to be able to go out and do what they do. So they owe you probably as much as you owe them.
And that was, interestingly, what took place during the hearing. There were in-the-weeds kind of science questions that came from very astute members of Congress. And to Carol's credit, she flipped the ball back over to me. And this is, you know, we were a tag team. And it was just beautiful and wonderful to be part of that.
Well, Dominic, it's always fun to talk to you and get to hear what the latest that you've been up to. So thanks so much for being on Locus Focus. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Barbara. You take care.
We've been talking with Dominic De La Salle, a chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Ashland, Oregon. And you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO, or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with writer Marion Lavelle about how human-induced climate change and the war on Ukraine are both rooted in our dependence on fossil fuels. We'll go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Fire on the mountain.